We'll call the Special Subcommittee on the ANWR hearings to order. It's 9:10 and it's April the 13th. We're in Kodiak. Let the record show that Senator Duncan, Senator Sturgiolowski, Senator Jones, and Chairman Senator Coghill are present. We have the Chairman of the Special Oil and Gas Subcommittee from the Senate, Senator Fehrenkamp, with us, and we also have two Senators, Senator Eliason and Senator Zoroff, that are attending the hearings today. The purpose of the hearings today is we've had a series of hearings. We had one hearing in Fairbanks, in Anchorage, in Ketchikan, and now in Kodiak. And we're going to try and concentrate more on the land exchange and the related subjects around the land exchange to try and get on the record the thinking of the people within the native corporations, the native community, and to get those things on the record. We also have Mr. Doble from the Department of Interior is here, and we had most of the representation from the state and the federal agencies to ask questions if we have questions arise. And we hope that we'll be able to go until about noon, and then come back in at 1:30 and go until about 4. We ought to be able to accomplish everything that we're setting out to accomplish today. So with that in mind, we'll go ahead and ask the communities around the Cognac area. We have Walt Erickson from Old Harbor. We have Judy Miedemeyer from Eric Elsuak. I'm not going to try and pronounce that name. Jim Wilkins, Rick Hackma, and we have the table here, we'd like to just kind of have a round table discussion. So would all of you folks come forward, and we'll or anybody else, Judy, that I've missed?
I don't believe so, unless there's somebody here that would like to sit with us. Apparently, Mr. Hawksworth is not present.
If he should show up, why, we could get him to come in. And I think that what we ought to do is, for the record, when we're speaking or we're answering a question of the committee, why, if you'll mention your name, and that way it'll make it easier for the record, because most of this, most of these proceedings are basically in order to get something on record so that when the record is published and the determinations are made by the committee, that we have some track. With that, I guess we would like to have you, if you're prepared, to make an opening statement. Is that the way we want to do this? So, Judy, would you go ahead and lead off?
Well, I was going to offer a chance for the villages to do that, and then...
Sure, fine. Okay. Just you run the table from that end.
Thank you.
Okay. Good morning, Senator Coghill, Senator Sturgiolowski, and other members of the Senate Resources Committee, Senator Zaroff from our region. My name is Ralph Iluska, and I work for the Akiak Kaluya Corporation. I would like to, at this time, introduce members of the Board of Directors of Akiak Kaluya. It just so happens that today we are having our annual meeting here in Kodiak, and so I feel fortunate that we have some of our board members here today, and they decided that instead of having our scheduled board meeting prior to our annual meeting this afternoon, they chose to attend these hearings this morning. And I would like to introduce Andy Kahutak here, who's the president of Akiak Kaluyak. Fred Coyle is the vice president. Board member Vera Inga. Board member Senefon Zeter. And we have some stockholders present also, if they would also stand. Kostya, Albert, Mitch, and some in the back there. Of course, they're all very interested in hearing what we have to say, and and what your interests are in the land trade. And we thank you again for the opportunity to testify before you. We testified in Anchorage, and our statement then was that our first position is that we are very definitely interested in seeing the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge opened for the state of Alaska. And secondly, we are, to that extent then, we ask the state's support and interest in seeing that our land trades also go through. Several years ago, the United States government expressed an interest in reacquiring the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. And Kodiak seized upon that interest and has kept that interest alive. And so we're working with the government and working toward an agreement. We're coming close. The United States government is interested in acquiring our lands. Akyak Kuguyak is interested in returning the lands to the government. So we have a willing purchaser. At this point, we have a willing seller. Also, the environmentalists I'd like to quote from a hearing that was held by the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had a hearing held February 5th, 1986 on the subject of the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge Comprehensive Plan. Mr. David Klein, representing the National Audubon Society and including members in Alaska, testified February 5th at a hearing held by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, DOI, on the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge Comprehensive Plan. I quote, "I think that the service should make a special effort to cooperate with the local people and see if there are ways to acquire the land, exchange the land, or possibly even lease it." That's the end of quote. And then quoting Cliff Landisman at that same hearing, he was representing the Alaska Center for the Environment, quoting, "Some very productive fish and wildlife habitat has been conveyed to village corporations and allottees. The fish and wildlife should vigorously explore the possibility of purchasing or trading for these lands if the present owners are willing to do so." And we are acting, and we are certainly doing that. And so recently we have, the state of Alaska has been involved, but has up to now has chosen to withdraw. And we request through you, representing the state of Alaska and the interests of all of Alaska, that you convince the governor that it is in all of our best interest that he supports the land trades. And so it's simply stated, we in Akyak and Kuguyak are most sincerely interested in opening ANWR, and we sincerely request your support in seeing that the land trades are also supported. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Senator Fernicamp.
Yes, I was most interested in your comments from the testimony of the Audubon Society, since I noticed in the March 19th filing in U.S. District Court that the National Audubon Society is entering in the lawsuit to try to stop the land trades on a preliminary and permanent injunction. I wondered if you were taking part in that or sending any information or copies of that testimony.
Yes, we are taking part. It's Jim Wilkins, he's general counsel for Akyak, and he can answer the particulars. But we have requested to intervene. But we are also, we're also wondering about the agendas that the environmentalists may have. Because on the one hand, we do have testimony that they would like to see these trades take place. On the other hand, we see them now trying to interrupt that process.
Senator, we recently filed a motion to intervene in that action, as I believe most of the other Native groups intend to do, primarily so that we preserve our ability to present our point of view to the judge in that proceeding. As you pointed out, that lawsuit involves a complaint seeking declaratory judgment, specifically injunctive relief, precluding further negotiations. The plaintiffs in that case have named only the federal defendants and not the Native participants. Obviously, if we don't have a federal partner to deal with, we can't negotiate either. So we have sought to intervene in that case so as to present our point of view. Your question, though, brings out another interesting point, and that is that we've got Dave Klein, whose Audubon Society is one of the named plaintiffs in that case, making a statement at one hearing that the federal government should seek to regain or reobtain title to some of the land, such as in Kodiak Island, and at the same time is participating in a lawsuit in which his group is attempting to preclude further negotiation. I think this illustrates what we have said throughout, and that is that in order to open ANWR, we're going to need to have a united front, a united state in Congress. And one of the things that we have said throughout is in order to present a package to Congress that will be acceptable, we need to bring into that package something that will be acceptable to the environmental groups or environmental community on a nationwide basis. One of the things that we intended to do in these land exchanges to further that end is to put up land, such as the land that's being exchanged on Kodiak Island and elsewhere, for the environmental concerns. And I think that Dave Klein's comments are illustrative of what the Audubon Society really would like to see. They would like to see our land come back. I don't think that they would like that to be their first position, but I think they understand that that will be the eventual position they'll need to take, that the ANWR needs to be opened, that as part of that, that has to be included the exchange process, including reobtaining the land in Kodiak Island.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sir, Senator Strzelecki.
Mr. Chairman, just to pursue that a little bit, one of the things that we have on record as a result of the hearings has been just a very flat statement by the environmental community that we don't care what you do in terms of mitigation or terms of, say, 90-10, 50-50, whatever, we are opposed. And they seem to be, that's rather a hard position that's been carried out by the lawsuit. And I guess the question might be, what do you foresee happening in court, that a premature ruling on that could have very chilling effect on the whole question of ANWR? Do you have any feeling at all how that might proceed through the system, the court system?
I don't really. It's certainly early to in our proceeding. I haven't taken a close enough look at the merits of that suit to determine exactly what our defense would be. And quite frankly, I don't think it would be appropriate for me to voice what our strategy would be in that action. But I think what my feeling on that lawsuit is that this is an attempt primarily to delay the process, and that what they're really seeking is an environmental impact statement, which of course could be, and we could do that voluntarily if we wanted. Perhaps that wouldn't even slow down the process. One thing we have been discussing as a potential strategy is perhaps what should be done is there should be an agreement to do the EIS, just so that we can keep the process on track. Quite frankly, I don't see that that's going to slow us down either way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Ralph. Judy, who's next?
Mr. Erickson will be next.
Yeah, good morning, Senators. Charles, Senator Cogdell, the rest of the people here. My name is Walt Erickson. I'm a 28-year resident of Old Harbor and the Vice President of the Old Harbor Native Corporation. I want to thank the committee for taking time to listen to the testimony of those of us on Kodiak, our opinions and our input we have to offer. I appreciate the opportunity to express the views of those and most closely affected by the opening of ANWR. The members of Old Harbor Native Corporation are strongly in favor of opening the coastal plains and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for all exploration. First and foremost, the development of our oil resources on the North Slope means money and jobs for Alaska. The current recession is hurting our not only our economy, but practically halting the growth and progress of this state, and has made the last 20 years. At one time, Alaska population was growing by leaps and bounds, and now the people are leaving almost as fast as they came. The most unfortunate part of our flight from our state is that we are losing many of our lifelong residents, both native and non-natives alike, unable to support themselves and their families, and our young men and our women are forced to leave Alaska and seek employment elsewhere. This drains our state's most valuable resources, its people. For Native Alaskan, it separates individuals from their ancestral homes and divides the family structure, which is the heart of our culture. This is devastating for us that is trying to preserve a unique heritage and culture. Opening the coastal plain for development would give our economy a much-needed shot in the arm, provide jobs, and once more make Alaska the state to live in. Next, our opening of Anwar is a second chance for Alaska. When the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was built, I think we all believed that the good times would last forever. We are here on Kodiak understanding the feeling. It is similar to our king crab and shrimp situation. We always thought the king crab would be here. We did not make plans to develop any other resource just in case the kings disappeared. Then one day they were gone. Kodiak was once the king crab capital of the world. Now we must plan and develop other resources without the benefit of guaranteed industry to back us up. We are making changes, trying our hand at other types of fishing and experimenting with the mariculture. But it has not been and not will be an easy task. But Alaska has a second chance. This time we know the oil will not last forever. We can plan and develop our state so we can keep growing and not be so dependent on one industry. We need the oil and to get us started. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline, Prudhoe Bay, and Kenai National Wildlife Refuge are all proof that we can utilize oil and gas resources available to us without disrupting environment. No one wants our beautiful state stripped of its wildlife, trees, mountains, and streams. If there are concerns about the environment, then it is up to our state government to provide and protect in the ways of the laws and regulatory agencies. Finally, oil in Alaska means oil for Americans, produced by Americans. There are millions of petroleum byproducts manufactured in this country, providing millions of jobs and services for us nationwide. They underscore the need for American-produced oil. Alaska has the oil. We are obligated to develop it so that this country can function independently as possible from foreign oil production. The Native corporations in Kodiak have a personal stake in the opening of the coastal plains. There's a proposed exchange where corporations will receive subsurface rights to the coastal plains in exchange for subsurface rights in currently hold on Kodiak Island. Our Old Harbor Native Corporation is offering private lands within the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge and the Arctic National Maritime Refuge in exchange for subsurface rights in Anwar lands. Old Harbor is offering approximately 35,000 acres on Kodiak Island and 54,089 acres on Sitka-Leedik Island and its small surrounding islands. If the exchange takes place, these lands will become public and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will gain absolute control over them. For everyone concerned, this is an exciting proposition. For the Old Harbor Native Corporation, we will obtain certain subsurface rights and ensure financial security for our people and community, and still have the subsurface rights to our ancestral lands that we subsistence rights to our ancestral lands that we have always had. Fish and wildlife will gain and a kind of a blanket protection of refuge that it needs to order and to manage wildlife habitats in a manner constituent with National Wildlife Refuge goals. This is especially significant in the case of Sitka-Leedik Island because it is not subject to 22G restrictions. The Old Harbor lands are rich with resources. Primarily, there are Kodiak brown bear on our lands. As a primary purpose for the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge, this unique species of brown bear den and feed on Old Harbor lands. There is denning at Big Creek and Sitkalitik Island. We are fortunate to have rare phenomenon at Old Harbor. Many bears on Kodiak swim to Sitkalitik in the fall and to den and swim back to Kodiak in the spring to mate and feed. It is a sight well worth watching. In addition, we have two major bear trails running between Three Saints Bay and Barling Bay and between Barling Bay and Midway Bays. In addition to the bears, Old Harbor supports herds of mountain goats, nesting and feeding bald eagles, fox, beaver, land, sea otter, and very large deer population. the small islands around Sitkalitik are part of the Arctic National Maritime Wildlife Refuge. They are the homes for thousands of seabirds, including one of the two largest puffin mating areas surrounding Kodiak Island, supporting nearly 11,000 birds. These 10 small islands, when combined, provide nesting habitat for 36% of the seabirds in the southwest region of the Kodiak Archipelago. Moreover, there is large sea lion rookery at Cape Barnabas on Sitkalitik Island and a seal rookery at nearby Table Island. Gray whales annually migrate along our shoreline. Say humpback and finback whales can also be seen, but in smaller numbers. Killer whales are often seen in the nearshore areas of the mink, quail, doll, and harbor purposes. Old Harbor is also rich in historical significance. Three Saints Bay is the site of the first white settlement in Alaska. That Three Sisters Rush North settlement site is over 300 years old. There are at least 10 deleted as native villages dating back to hundreds of years, three of these on Sitkalitik. As you can see, the land in Old Harbor is offering a rich storehouse of resources and historical significance, which, if incorporated into a refuge, would be lasting legacy for visitors and residents alike. For these reasons, the Old Harbor Native Corporation supports the opening of coastal plains and for oil development and the purpose of land exchange. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Walt. Is there any questions? Walt, maybe one of your legal people can answer this, but what guarantees do you have that you're going to have continuing subsistence rights on that land once the federal people take it back? Is it in law? Is it in statute? Is it a contractual agreement that they can't later freeze you out of it? Or what is there to guarantee that?
Walt Ebel will answer that question.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Walt Ebel, and we represent Old Harbor Native Corporation. And as the committee may or may not be aware, there is a subsistence easement which will be retained by the village corporation, guaranteeing them access to the lands in perpetuity for purposes of subsistence uses. And that will be a contractual agreement between the corporation and the United States government.
Chairman, may I comment on that as well? Jim Wilkins for Akiak. As I understand it, in addition, although it is a contractual right, it's also going to be written into the deeds transferring the property over to the United States. So although it would be a contractual right, and actually the contractual right is going to go back into a statutory right because it will simply incorporate the ASA and ANILCA language by reference, and that language will not only appear in the contractual agreement between the Native corporations and DOI, it will also appear in the deed so as to give, obviously, constructive notice to the world that we do have, the Native groups do have a continuing interest in that land.
Jim, is this true with all of the land exchanges, not only just Old Harbor or Akwayak, but is it
business? Yes, that would be one provision that would be uniform throughout all the agreements.
Just a comment with regard to the easements. It's a right of access that would be triggered only if somehow or another ANILCA would be repealed, the subsistence provision in ANILCA. It's extra insurance. Currently, the lands are managed for subsistence purposes under the laws passed under the regulations when ANILCA was passed. And in the event that something should happen as a result of state action through ANILCA or federal action to repeal that law, then the subsistence easement, which provides a right of access, recognizing that all resources are managed by the state of Alaska, a fish and game, and we're subject to those laws. Sure. So this provides that in perpetuity.
Okay. Judy, are you next then?
I think so.
Presentation.
I want to thank you for coming to Kodiak. We appreciate the opportunity to have you here in our community and to meet with our people and to talk with us firsthand. I think it's probably with regard to the effort that you are making in talking to the people who are directly involved, I think it provides a greater perspective for the resolution that you're considering. And we're very happy to have you, welcome you here, and want you to enjoy your stay here. The weather is not as good as we would like it, but brightens you up and gets you started early. My name is Judy Meidinger. I'm the chairman of Kodiak, the regional corporation here in Kodiak. We represent about 3,300 shareholders who are enrolled to this region under the land claims. The Kodiak Corporation acquired through merger with two of its village corporations, actually more, but we had a demerger, and we retained about in excess of 100,000 acres as a result of acquiring village lands through the merger in the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge on the south end of the island. The lands that we are talking about exchanging are these lands. And the reason that we are talking about exchange is because the federal government desperately wants those lands back into the refuge system. When I say into the refuge system, they are in the refuge system. They happen to be, the lands that we hold, just happen to be private in holdings. We own the land, but they are managed under Fish and Wildlife regulations. The lands that we hold, unlike other lands, cannot be acquired through condemnation by the United States. It's also apparent to us that the government does not have the funds with which to purchase these lands. However, they have very high recreational value, they have very high scenic value and other environmental values to not only the United States but to people in Alaska as well. In recognition of the importance of the lands and the threat that private ownership of them poses to the integrity of the refuge, the department has been wanting to acquire title to them and has been talking to Kodiak for several years about acquiring that title. We began talking in 1982, and at that time, Kodiak was going to had an agreement to exchange the lands in return for bidding chips in the Outer Continental Shelf. For a number of reasons, this did not come to be. So when that idea passed, we again began discussion with regard to the exchange for rights to coastal plain lands in the Anwar. We have been discussing this for several years, I think since 84, and have entered into serious negotiations with the Department of Interior at that time. We've identified the lands that we will return to the federal government. We have not yet identified any lands in the coastal plain simply because the process of negotiating our agreement hasn't brought us to that stage yet. We had to get a lot of other things in place in terms of our negotiation with them before we get to identification of lands in the Anwar. Presently, there are five groups, five native corporations or groups of native corporations which are discussing the exchange possibilities. At one time, the state of Alaska was also a participant, but withdrew from the negotiations in February. While we do not have the exact number of acres which may be exchanged, there are about or approximately 1 million acres of native land holdings involved. Any exchange which might occur would be conditioned upon two events occurring: the opening of Anwar to oil and gas development and production, and congressional ratification of the exchanges. One thing that is very important to understand is that this is not an acre-for-acre exchange. When we talk about exchange, we're talking about a comparable value exchange. Through a process of valuing Kodiak land, several different ways of determining value was arrived at. We had appraisals done on real estate values. We had the feds had a way of deciding what the bear denning habitat value might be worth. the birds, the scenic beauty, the recreational values, though all those values were taken into consideration in determining what might be the value of Coney Egg lands. Likewise, the value of lands in the Anwar are going to be determined based on the potential for oil and gas that might be there. In terms of the exchange, when you get down to the values, we believe that the groups collectively will be fortunate if we can obtain at the maximum perhaps 25,000 to 50,000 acres. And that is an exchange for one in excess of 1 million acres of inholdings that we have. From Coney Egg's discussions with Interior, it's occurred to us that given the values involved, and we believe that there are very high values in the Anwar, it's not going to be possible for Coney Egg to obtain the best tracts available. Obviously, the better the tract, the greater its value. Such high-value tracts will still be available for any lease sale which might be held. Furthermore, Coney Egg has also been advised that the Department of Interior will not make all of the lands in the coastal plain available for exchange. The department intends to hold back out of each structure a certain percentage of the lands for lease sales. Thus, if exploration programs are conducted on the exchanged lands in advance of a lease sale, the information generated by such exploration programs will be made available to the Department of Interior to further determine the minimum acceptable bids for any subsequent lease sale. If oil were to be discovered on any of the exchanged tracts, the values of the adjacent tracts available for lease would obviously dramatically increase. It's also important to know that the interest that we will receive in Anwar is not a surface estate interest, but it's a limited right to extract oil and gas for a fixed period of time, which would end at some point down the road. What it closely resembles is would be similar to a lease sale, that the Department of Interior would retain certain rights and that we would be given limited rights. Surface activities would be closely regulated under state and federal law to prevent unnecessary adverse effects to the environment. Exchange interests will be subject to the same environmental standards as the federal lessees. Gravel would continue to be owned by the United States, and holders of the inholdings will merely have the right to purchase it at fair market value. Access will also be closely regulated as the result of agreed-upon waiver of Title IX rights for inholders. Interior has already indicated that, in addition to the foregoing, the owners of the interest will probably not be allowed to make selections in particularly environmentally sensitive areas, such as the calving grounds, wherever they may be. Although the areas available for selection will not be defined until after the 1002 report has been submitted to Congress. Finally, any development on the exchange tracts would be subject to applicable state and federal laws and regulations. It's also important to know that as private corporations, we would be subject to the same tax laws and the same payments, severance taxes, whatever, to the state of Alaska as any other corporation. I think that's important. There's been some misunderstanding about that, but we would be treated no differently from any other corporation. We'd like to talk a little bit about the state's concerns. And we know that the state, and when I say the state, I'm speaking of the administration. As we currently understand the position of the state, it has several basic concerns. Number one concern, I believe, is that Anwar be open for further exploration and development. The other concern is that the 90% share of royalty revenues not be diminished. And the third, that the state has concerns regarding the regulatory scheme for operations to be conducted on exchange lands. I believe there's a lot of misunderstanding again about the state's share. My understanding of that share, I read in newspapers about the 90% share of mineral exploration, oil development. I think a lot of people don't understand that it's 90% of a smaller percent. Whatever the royalty share might be, I believe 12.5%. So it's 90% of that, if it's 90%. I believe also that other states get 50% of revenues, royalty revenues. I think the negotiations or the share that would be obtained in the National Petroleum area NPRA is 50%. And so it's not an across-the-board 90% split, no matter what the federal government does. And I also believe that Congress will determine in the legislation with regard to opening of ANWR what the state's share might be. I think that the state has a strong position, or should have a strong position, in negotiating its share. It's our belief that if the exchanges were to occur without the sharing with the state in any royalty, because the federal government is not going to retain a royalty interest in the exchange lands. Therefore, if it doesn't retain a royalty interest, how can it give the state a percentage of that interest? However, the state could make the argument that because their royalty interest or their interest percentage interest would be diminished by the exchange, therefore the likelihood of gaining or acquiring a larger percentage in the remaining lands might be made. It might be stronger to make that argument because of the exchanges.
Judy, we'll stop right there for a minute. Senator Jones had a question, then Senator Farenkamp had a question, because I think you ran us around the barn a little fast on that one.
I've been rehearsing.
Judy, let me commend you people for having the foresight to get involved in this and seeing the value out there. I think that's really, you should be congratulated for that and get some of that in private hands. There's nothing wrong with it at all. And you mentioned that the federal government was interested in keeping a percentage of the structures holding back further lease sales. Have the negotiations gone far enough that where they have said actually what percentage of any particular structure they like to keep?
I don't believe that they've really defined the areas. I have a feeling that, and again, I'm not involved directly in the negotiations, but they will decide what portions of the structures that they will offer for us to, quote, bid on, and they know what those are, and what they retain for a lease sale is something that we don't know yet. But it's clear to us that we're not going to get a first pick of the best. It's going to be reserved for later.
And we are talking about those 20-some structures that they add up on the wall and maps.
Not being a geologist, nor having looked at the maps, I don't know how many there are, nor what the value is, but I suspect there are those who do know.
Yes. All right, Judy, thank you. Senator Farenkamp.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Judy, I hate to hear you comparing the Coastal Plain to NPR as far as the percentage of the 90-10 split or the 50 split. I think it's important that the people of this state understand what we're talking about on the 90%, 10% percentage of royalties, federal royalties. Most states do not indeed get 50-50, but they do have 50-40, and 40% of those funds go into reclamation funds that every other state in the lower 48 is eligible for and receive payments out of. The state of Alaska does not. That was the reason we had the 90-10. And for us to look at just saying, well, we got 50% in NPR, so that makes it all right, doesn't hold water, because we got to the 50% in NPR from a zero percentage that was not included in the 90-10 percentage of royalties. And I think it's important that people hearing the testimony don't get confused on that. I think that's one thing we're all in agreement on this committee, and it would be unfair for us not to let you know that.
I think that, if I'd be allowed to finish my discussion on the percentage, CONIAG does not take issue with the state's desire to retain its fair share, whether it's 90 or 50 or 75. Our position is that if the state and the federal government can make some agreement as to what that share ought to be, that our tracts, that we do not do our exchange on a value-for-value exchange and then find that our interests are encumbered by a negotiation that was not included in our negotiation with the Department of Interior, that if the state can obtain its share, 90% share, we would support that. But we believe that that's an issue between the state and the federal government, and we don't really want to get in the middle of that.
Does that answer your question, Senator? Senator Betty?
Well,
I'm sorry.
That bothers me, because you say it's an interest to the state, but not of an interest to you. And you are members of this state.
What I said was we would support that. We would support the state's position with regard to that
okay.
90%.
It's not that I'm wanting 90% of any land you exchange or any of that stuff, but I do hope that's one place we are at least in agreement.
No, I want to make it very clear is that our interest as citizens of the state is that the state get its fair share. I think the point that I'm making is that we are negotiating an exchange. The state has an involvement of its own, and we believe that that's sort of arm's length. We can support whatever position the state takes, if it will take a position that we can, so far we haven't seen that yet, and we need to be able to work with them if they would simply come forward and be involved with us.
Thank you,
Judy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator, please. Pursue this just a little bit. I might make a comment. I think that you and Ralph and hearings and before Commonwealth North have represented the interests of your respective organizations very well and have been very knowledgeable. I'd like to explore just a little bit the potential tax and situation. Now, the state of Alaska, let's say that this land trades go through for you and for others. The state would still receive severance taxes, would still receive corporate taxes. But the am I correct that any kind of a lease bonus bid, et cetera, would in your case, if you acquired this, accrue to you? Is that correct?
That's correct.
And also then when we deal with the royalty, is that a portion of the negotiation that you have with the Department of Interior as to what your portion would be and what the federal government would retain, or would you accrue? How does that work?
The negotiations are for rights, 100% of the rights of any oil and gas that might be there.
I see.
The federal government will not retain any of those royalty rights.
And your comment then on the record was that in those lands that the state would no longer have an interest in, they would in effect lose, if it's 90% or 50% of
correct.
The 12.5% of the royalty. Is that correct?
Yes. If the federal government does not retain that royalty, then it obviously can't transfer any of that to the state.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of other questions. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I'm Mr. Chairman.
Ralph.
You know, it bothers me that we make the comparisons. On the one hand, we are supportive of the state's position to open ANWR and I stated before, to the extent that we can, and the arguments that we can make to support the state's position on 90-10, we certainly want to get in behind you, as other members of the state will. But then on the other hand, the state losing royalty interest on what we would get, on the other hand, goes to the other extreme. Because we feel like that, as I said, we have a interested party jeopardized that transaction. And so I don't see it in the way you describe it, that the state is losing that percentage of royalty. I see it as a state supporting a private enterprise and in gaining an economic foothold in this free enterprise. And I see that you play a very key role in seeing that takes place.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of very brief questions. You talked about the fact you would be subsurface and have no rights in surface. Am I correct that Kaktovik, which has very substantial, like about 120,000 acres of surface rights, and then ASRC has subsurface, I believe those are contiguous. So you would only receive subsurface to federally held land. Is that correct? And then what is the process? You enter into a conditional agreement. At what point do you need to go to your shareholders?
Our plan is to actually, it's slipped several times because of our negotiations with Interior have been delayed from time to time. We had originally intended to have our special shareholders meeting this spring to
put forth a proxy to explain the exchange and to have them vote on it. Our current schedule is to have a special shareholders meeting in November. I believe it's the 5th or around the 5th of November. We have, state law requires that we have approximately a 60-day window to solicit that proxy, and our proxy will go in the mail on or about the first week of September.
So. Conceivably, Congress could act prior to...
Well, they could.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Jim Wilkins, Rock.
I would like to have you say your name because the tape over there can't see you.
Jim Wilkins, Rock. Judy had mentioned that the federal government does not retain any royalty interest, which in fact is not technically correct in some of the contracts, because in some of the contracts there will be a partial right of rescission. The legal consideration for that right of partial rescission will be a royalty interest, an overriding royalty interest, which will be retained by the federal government. That is not a provision that's uniform throughout the contracts. It's a provision that's unique to those parties wishing to retain some right of rescission. So I wanted to clarify that, because Akiak is one of those parties who are retaining a partial right of rescission.
Judy Meininger for Koniag. We are retaining a right of rescission, and there is a cost for that rescission, sort of like an insurance policy. However, it's not the same kind of royalty interest that would be negotiated in a lease sale, and therefore it's a negotiated royalty interest in terms of our right to rescind the contract at some point. And it's a limited right, but the cost is a percentage.
Senator Zara.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question here, or maybe a comment first. I appreciate the committee coming down. I think it's important for the community to have this opportunity to address the committee that's addressing this particular issue, since the three major villages there that have lands are in this region. But I guess I go back to the Terror Lake days, and when you talked about the exchange of land roughly for Koniag's 1 million acres, you're looking at trading for approximately 25,000.
Actually, Fred, it's the native collectively in excess of a million, and I think the least amount is about 25,000. Probably the maximum amount is about 50,000 acres.
Well, I go back to the ratio there that we had to use in order to get Terror Lake complete. If you're familiar with the Terror Lake project, we're right at the edge of the bear refuge, and in order to get the agreement to allow the water level to rise on the perimeter of the lake, roughly taking in about 2,000 acres, we had to concede to giving up management of about 44,000 acres on the Shearwater Peninsula, which at that time it was good for the federal government to say, well, we're going to get 44,000 acres for 2,000. And then when you turn this thing around, now in a sense, what if you go at the 25,000 to 1 million ratio, it's 1 to 40 the other way. And if you take their figures and say that one of their acres is worth 20, that's actually 25,000 to roughly 20 million acres. And that even expands a little bit further, so it's 1 to 800. So I guess there's no real consistency that I see in this mechanism as it goes along. Or whatever glove fits, you know, for the controlling hand, I guess that's the way it happens to go. But, you know, I've had some concerns all along about how things progress on through, and I guess I'm just concerned there that at least the people of this region are getting an equitable return for the amount of land that they are having to concede to. And I'm searching somewhere in my memory banks, and I can't remember where, but I thought at one time I'd heard that the villages that are on the perimeter of the bear refuge, there was some clause built in for expansion. If the village expanded, you were then allowed to move a little further into the bear refuge. And if that was the case, if the lands that the villages that are entitled to are on the perimeter of their current boundaries, and they turn these lands over under the current provisions, is that going to prohibit any future expansions, as let's say as the village grows?
There's approximately, as Judy Meininger with Koniag, there's approximately 36,000 acres of land that surround the Karlik village that is going to be retained. There are approximately 23,000 acres surrounding the village of Larsen Bay, which will be retained. So there's a buffer area for those villages.
Chairman, is that buffer within the bear refuge now, or is it outside?
Some of them are bear refuge, some are not. And I don't have the exact numbers of which are and which are not.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Zoroff. Is there another question? Are you through with your written presentation?
I'm hardly.
You're hardly even started. Go ahead.
One of the sort of important points or keys to us in terms of the ANWR, we believe, is that it addresses a number of issues. It addresses the environmental concerns in terms of the as a mitigation measure for the ANWR, that you just don't deal with whether or not there's environmental impacts in the ANWR, but here is an opportunity for valuable refuge land to be returned to the system in excess of 1 million acres. And if the state would get involved in these land trades, we believe that there's probably another 600,000 to 1 million acres that the state has that could be part of that system. And so to us, it's a very strong mitigating influence on the ANWR, that you're just not dealing with the environmental impacts to a core calving area, but you're also dealing with the mitigation here of returning valuable land to the federal government, land that they could not otherwise acquire or would not otherwise acquire. We also believe that if this opportunity passes, it will not present itself again. And so it's critical, we believe, for not only the state and the federal government, but also for the Native corporations' economic future. And we think that once it's gone, it will not come back. So it's really important for us to be aware and involved. And on top of it, one more comment I had about shareholders, and I think your question was important. Koniag is working very closely with its shareholders. I have the responsibility as chairman to keep in close communication with all of our villages and with the leadership in those villages. And currently, we have support for the opening of ANWR. Villages have passed resolutions with regard to the opening and in support of the land exchanges. What this really means, though, is that while Koniag is involved, we support other regions in their efforts to exchange lands. There may be some point at which Koniag would decide with Interior that there's what we call a deal breaker, that there's a condition placed upon the exchange that we find unacceptable, and then we would withdraw from the negotiation. That does not mean that we do not support other regions and other corporations in their exchange efforts, or even the state of Alaska, should it wish to get involved in an exchange effort. So we're very much in favor of those exchanges, whether or not we're involved or not. We're also very much in favor of the opening of ANWR, not just as Native corporations, but as citizens, because we see the benefits of development from Prudhoe Bay. We think that there will be general economic benefit to the state as a whole from the opening of ANWR. We talk about diversification of our resources and our economy. But, you know, we're in the oil business. That is our economy. And any other economy pales by comparison. I mean, I have lived here. I was born and raised here. I know what the fishing industry is like. I know what the timber industry is like. I know what the tourism is like. And it comes and it goes. But we're in the oil business. We have been for a long time. I think this represents a unique opportunity for a partnership that existed only at one time, and that's when the state and the Native corporations and the oil and gas industry was involved in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. I think this represents another unique opportunity for that kind of partnership and working together, and I think we ought to do it. Thank you.
Are you done?
I'm done.
What we're going to do we're going to take a coffee break, and then we're going to come back, and I'd like to have you folks come back, and then what we'll do is have the panel ask some questions. We hope that we can get through that series of it by noon today, and then be able to go to some of the industry and maybe some of the federal state to clarify anything that the committee's got. We'll go to public. Maybe we'll be able to be done by 4 or 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
We want to catch that plane tonight. Yes?
Yes, just one question. I wanted to mention that Ralph Lucia with Akyak mentioned that the members of Akyak Huyak that are present did express an interest besides me speaking on behalf of Akyak, that they wanted to preserve the right to also come up to say, express their interest. So I wanted to...
What we had in mind, Ralph, is having you as a kind of a panel this morning to kind of give a organized presentation, and then we'd go in, have break, then we'd come back and have you people here so that we can ask questions. We get through with that, we'll go to the industry and federals if they have any questions, then they would be in the public forum. We open up a portion of our schedule always to the public forum. So if there's no objections, why we'll take about a 15-minute coffee break. We want to acknowledge for the record that Marie Oswald had her junior high school class here this morning, and we were in the middle of testimony and we couldn't recognize them, but we want the record to indicate that they were here. We're back from our break. It's 10:30. Senator Zoroff, I noticed that your burro's still on old time. Or is that they're just behind time?
Kind of like to run on our own clock here.
That's right. You're lucky we're that close.
We have the group. We have Ralph. We have the group that testified this morning. What we're going to do is we're going to now open it up for questions that maybe the committee might have as far as their testimony or any other things in order to explain some of the differences. And for the record, I'll go ahead and start off with a couple items that maybe for the record, Judy or any of you folks, the attorneys at the table, explain the difference between the regional village corporations. Your relationship with Konya, a regional corporation, and your relationship with village corporations, with municipal corporations, with all of the organization, and what is your relationship in that regard, and in regard to the number of organizations throughout the state that are going forward with the ANWR, or are you doing that separately?
Judy Meininger with Koniag. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act allowed for groups to organize under state statute. And so all of the corporations are organized pursuant to state statute, which doesn't give us any particular breaks in terms of being Native corporations as opposed to any other corporation. All of the villages are organized in a similar fashion, and they are subject to state laws and everything that applies. The differences between Native corporations, whether they're village or region, are simply that we have captive shareholders. The captive shareholders are going to remain there until such time as there's a decision made to change that situation. But currently, that's the way it exists. The relationship that we have with our villages is arm's length. The village controls its own activities, it does its own business, it makes its own plans for whatever it does. Our relationship with other regions, again, is an arm's length one. We are corporations and they are corporations. We have very many common interests, and I think that's probably the binding factor. We belong to the same organizations, and we have the same set of rules under ANCSA that everybody else does. We are subject to those things. But in terms of our business operations, it is an arm's length situation. With regard to the land trades, Koniag has its negotiations with Interior on a separate basis, although in the same room, because we have our interests and our priorities in terms of what we want to see in the exchange agreement. Not speaking for the villages, but knowing of the differences, they have their own interests. There are some concessions they are willing to make that we are not. There are some concessions that we are willing to make that they are not. And so all of the agreements are being negotiated on a business basis as opposed to any other kind of basis. With regard to the regions and the villages, Koniag is negotiating for itself and the interest of 3,300 shareholders. Akiak-Kaguyak is negotiating for itself and their shareholders. And the Alaska Native Land Group is represented by Siri, which is representing, I think, approximately 12 or 13 villages in the Chulista region, and negotiating also some of its own land. I believe also that the Chulista Corporation is dedicating some of its subsurface rights for the exchange. Dion Limited and one of its villages is also involved, but Dion is negotiating for the village. Koniag is not negotiating for any of its villages. Collectively, this represents about, and I did some quick addition in my mind, but probably between 40 and 50,000 shareholders within the state. And I think that's a fair percentage of people involved in this transaction, or these transactions, I should say.
So my understanding then is that Koniag is not negotiating for Old Harbor or for any of the villages. They're coming in, they're doing their own negotiations. You're bringing them as partners to the table. You're negotiating subsurface rights.
We are negotiating
with their surface rights.
That's incorrect.
Okay.
All of the land that we are trading are surface rights only. Koniag did that. There was no subsurface rights granted with refuge lands. We only have surface rights, and so we are trading those surface rights for a limited subsurface interest.
That clears a lot of haze right there. Because I, you know, reading the Claim Settlement Act in the conveyance of lands under Section F, it says when the Secretary issues a patent to a village corporation for the surface estate in the lands pursuant to Section A and B, he shall issue the regional corporation for the region in which the lands are located a patent to the subsurface estate in such lands, except in lands in the National Wildlife Refuge System.
Right.
Is this the refuge system here? Also, that relates to the Bear Refuge as well as the Anwar area.
For your information, Judy Meininger, I have provided a map of the lands that Koniag is trading, and it's there with Mr. Garrity.
And so we find ourselves then in a mechanism, and the mechanism to exchange these lands within the ANWR is totally and strictly another piece of federal legislation that has to come by, that there's no mechanism in ANILCA to do that. Is that correct?
Yes.
Chairman Jim Wilkins for Akiak. I think that there's probably some legal questions involved in to answer that question. Right now, in order to avoid any such legal questions, we are proceeding on the assumption that we will require congressional approval of any exchange negotiation. As to whether or not congressional approval is legally required, I would say that's an open question, and that ANILCA may well provide a mechanism whereby the exchange could be done administratively rather than to get bogged down in that question, and from the legal standpoint and from the political standpoint, in order to allow Congress to have its stamp of approval on the exchanges, we are proceeding on the assumption that it will require, that the exchange will require congressional approval.
Ms. Judy Meininger with Koniag. I don't know if many of you
we're aware of the proposed St. Matthew Siri exchange. There was also some Village Corporation land exchange involved. And the lawsuit that the environmentalists filed was successful in stopping that exchange. So we think that while administratively it's possible, congressional approval would just simply limit the opportunity for challenge.
Well, if Cognac can't get subsurface rights in the National Wildlife Refuge System, then where is the mechanism for the federal government to convey subsurface rights to you in Anwar?
I think what you have to do, Senator, is you have to read more of the statute to understand the mechanisms that are available for any of us to trade. First of all, the United States government is interested in reacquiring those refuge properties. Under the Claim Settlement Act, the capitalization of these corporations was through the Claim Settlement Act. We got land and money. And so, but in the refuge systems where we live, as opposed to lands in other parts of the state, we were required to select refuge land because it was where we lived. And but also in that same legislation, where the region in other locations, other regions would have the subsurface, Cognac being having villages and refuge then had to go get lands in lieu of that subsurface. In this case, they had subsurface provided to them on their peninsula, Alaska Peninsula. But separate from that, you have Cognac with its villages, similar to Akyak, that has a surface. So that's totally separate from their in-lieu subsurface over on the mainland. So they're not trading their subsurface for subsurface. They're trading village surface, as Akyak is, for subsurface in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Senator Walt Ebell from Old Harbor,
yes.
If I might follow up on that. The federal government trade of subsurface rights in Anwar is permitted under provisions of ANILCA, which is legislation which followed ANGSCA. And that's where the authority to enter into the trade is located.
Okay, now, I remember that now. And so, does this preclude you folks, Cognac and the others, from participating in the 7I, or is the 7I kick in? Does the 7I kick in with subsurface exchanges because it's a regional nature? And would you be required then to share with the other regions that revenues that come off of the 7I?
Judy Meiger with Cognac. With regard to 7I and the exchanges, it is not presently part of our exchange agreement with Interior. There's no language in our draft agreement that speaks to 7I. The reason for that is fairly simple, and that is that these are former village lands that we acquired surface rights to, surface estate that we acquired under our merger plan. Village lands are not subject to any 7I sharing provisions. Secondly, some years ago, all of the regional corporations entered into a 7I agreement. The terms of the 7I agreement spell out what 7I options there are. Exchange lands, surface for subsurface, are not subject to 7I provisions. Village lands, surface for subsurface, are not subject to 7I provisions. Therefore, with regard to our lands, and those are the former village lands, there is no 7I provision written in because we already have the agreements in place that spell out what those 7I provisions are, and this is not subject to that.
When I just got a couple others, and then we can get to that. We'll go back to the we go back to the consensus regarding the overriding royalties, and by the state and the native corporations. I guess the 7I, the overriding royalties, the right for the native, for the private corporations to be able to negotiate and to be able to sell their lease rights or whatever it is. That's where the revenues are going to come from. I think that there's a total misperception out there in the public about the 90-10 and the overriding royalties. But how do you feel in the consensus regarding maybe getting the state back to the table by having some kind of a overriding royalty or a partnership or a sharing royalties with the state in regards to the selection of the land, so that we can stay within the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920. And the reason why I'm asking that question is that Section 9 of the Claims Act says that the provisions of this section shall apply to all minerals that are subject to the disposition under the Minerals Leasing Act of 1920 as amended. And then it goes in and it talks about the Alaska Native Fund. And of course, I wasn't around doing this job in the state at that time. I understand that the Alaska Native Fund was where all of the revenues went into, and then it was distributed out. And is this where the 7I money goes, if there would be any 7I money, and then be redistributed?
Judy Meininger with Koniak. The Alaska Native Fund existed only as long as revenues were flowing from the federal government and from the state government. When the last disbursement was made to the corporations, that fund went out of existence. The way that 7I is handled now is that each corporation is required to file a quarterly return, as it were, a report to the other regions and to make payments if they're obliged to pay under 7I. And it's a situation that is handled among the corporations and not through the Native Fund.
So for all intents and purposes, quote-unquote, Native Fund is gone. It's dried up, gone away. I guess my last question, and I'll see if the committee's got, is that because of the Native Land Claim Settlement Act, and because of the underlying reason why we had the Native Land Settlement Act, and why it was projected from Congress, and why Congress responded to it, is to give a claim or to settle a claim that was made by those people that were here before. And I guess one of the concerns that I have as the chairman of the committee is what is happening as far as the organizations out there, the corporations are in giving up fee title to some of your lands for the temporary subsurface rights of oil or the possible oil in the coastal plains. And when that oil is pumped out, or if it's not found, what protection are we giving to the children that come along in year 2000? Have we got a provision here where we're protecting the heritage of your people down the road?
Yeah, that's a very important question, and it's one that in Akyak we've had many discussions about. And there's two aspects of the question. One, we feel that as we see the world population growing, that the penetration of the human population will work its way down to different parts of the world, including ours.
Kodiak.
That's right. And it's a very beautiful and attractive place. It's close enough from Anchorage that you can get here relatively quickly. And it's a concern of our village people that even today we see people moving in, trespassing, and that while we own the property, we see the adverse possession situations developing where people are coming in. And so we said, all right, now we have an opportunity here the best steward we see available to us to protect this lifestyle of ours, the hunting and fishing lifestyle, and the people with the means is the United States federal government. To the extent that they are interested in reacquiring that, and to the extent that we are interested in protecting our lifestyle, and then we can arrange a protection for our people in the foreseeable future through a resource company, that we don't take a, we don't roll the dice. We get a value established for the property. We arrange for that resource company to come as close to that value as possible. And so we take care of the two questions. One for our children after us, because of the bonus. And then two, we get the best possible steward for that lifestyle and that refuge wildlife habitat, taking care of that property. And then also we maintain a subsistence easement through the incorporated by contract into the land exchange. So I, you know, we've been concerned about that aspect, and I think we've attempted to cover those problems as we've seen them and protect ourselves there.
But we've seen the state of Alaska, you know, Ralph, go through a tremendous amount of wealth in a tremendously short period of time, and we still bond ourselves and let our kids and our grandkids and our great-grandkids pay for the services that we're providing for them now. And I'm just concerned about that if we shift from a P-title piece of land that you hold, and you go up there and you get a piece of land where you got the subsurface rights and you strike it rich, are you providing any provision for a heritage fund or a program where that you're going to invest, where that 25% or 50% of it is going to go into a fund that your generation can't touch?
I think Julie has a mind.
In terms of economic benefit to the people, it's been our concern all along. First of all, even before we got into a land trade situation, that somehow ANGSA be the tool for benefit to the people. Unfortunately, as many of you know, many of the corporations have, either through poor management, mismanagement, or no fault of their own, had difficult times and even surviving. Some have had to file Chapter 11 for reorganization. Others are not in a position to do anything positive for their shareholders in today's economic climate. Koniag has had its share of problems. We are currently in a profitable situation. It is not the kind of profitable situation that allows us to pay any dividends or to establish any long-term trusts for our shareholders. We believe that before we pay any dividends, that the contributed capital be repaid to the corporation. Aside from that, we also believe that there is considerable potential in the ANWR for tremendous financial gain to the corporation. While we see this as very positive, not only for us, for business partners, for economic growth in this area, we also see the danger that a lot of money brings. We've had our share of accountants and lawyers and consultants gaining, and not the corporation and not the shareholders. It is only in the very, very early talking stages, and we have more lawyers researching for us the possibility, or the, not the possibility, but a way to frame a permanent investment for the shareholders. And we started calling it a trust, and we started calling it a limited partnership. We started calling it a number of things. We have sort of slipped into calling it a permanent fund for shareholders, fashioned hopefully after, or maybe after, the Alaska Permanent Fund. And something, and the only stipulations that the board has put on the financial experts who are researching it for us is that it be set so that it cannot be dissolved except by a 95 or 99% vote of the shareholders, and we all know that that's almost impossible to get, and that would have to be a positive vote. The other requirement that we have placed is that it not flow through the corporation and be subject to any board tampering. that it flow bypass the corporation. The other requirement is that it be a larger percentage than a smaller percentage. And again, I think that we don't really know the amounts of money that we're talking about. But the sole purpose of this fund would be to benefit shareholders. And it would not be managed by the corporation, but by a separate board from the corporation. And again, those are very general terms, and I suspect when the language for this comes out, it will be a fairly hefty document. But at the same time, we recognize all the pitfalls that we've had to go through with ANGSA, and we don't want that to happen a second time around.
Seem to be answering, Senator Sturgis.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, explore just a couple of questions on value. Each one of the groups interested in the trades apparently has industry partners. Are those partners outside of the negotiation process? In other words, your deal is with the oil company. The oil company has no part in the negotiations with the federal government. Is that correct?
Judy Meyer with CONIAG. Insofar as our agreement is being negotiated with Interior, that is correct. There are at times certain provisions in the agreement that require that our partners look at those provisions, things that really we can't deal with in terms of downhole information, technical data, other information that they might need to work with, access stipulations, regulations that might hamper their ability or the economics of getting out and exploring and developing. Certainly it would do us no good to have an exchange where it was so severely restricted that any partner could not get out there and do any exploration work. So there's certain parts of it that we are not expert on that our partners need to advise us, but they are not involved in the negotiations.
Mr. Chairman,
as a third party.
Further question on that. You've made a great effort to determine the value of your lands that you'll be trading, and I'm sure that the federal government has assigned values. And we've had earlier testimony about how the process will work, or potentially work, when you get back and actually you're putting up specific land, and then you're going to be seeking to bid on specific land. Are you going through a process of valuing those tracts, as well as the federal government going through the process of assigning value?
The tracts are being valued as they would be valued in a lease sale by the federal government. And what we will be involved with is sort of a bidding process with whatever value that we have to bring to the table. I suspect that each company that's involved has some idea about what they consider the value to be, and they generally hold that pretty close. And we all know that the companies that bid at lease sales can be very close together, or they can be very far apart on what they consider the value to be. CONIAG is not in a position to determine the values of any of those tracts, but we will use our best information and what value we have to sort of bid like a lease sale on this.
Just a final question. Why do you think, why do you think the state should be back at the table? And to maybe answer that, and would it be a primary reason that you feel that would advance, say, your role in seeing land trades accomplished?
Walt Ebell from Old Harbor. Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'll take
sure.
The first crack at that. In our estimation, the state should be participating in the trades for the benefit of the state as a whole. At the point in time that the state withdrew from the trades, it was our understanding that approximately 800,000 acres of state land was under consideration for trading. This would have made the state approximately a 40% participant in the trades. If the state's concern about the trades is loss of revenue, by participating in the trades, the state recoups the vast majority of any allegedly lost revenue the state would incur because of the trades. By our analysis, we do not think the state loses by the trades. In fact, we think that the state benefits by the trades, not only from a revenue standpoint, but from a social standpoint. And we think that that is one subject that has not been addressed by the state, is the fact that you have over 1 million acres of private land. And I would stress the word private. I think that's a concept that people have not accepted regarding these lands. These are private corporations. These are private lands. And they have the right to exercise their rights on those lands as private landholders. Now, they have been, I would say, reluctant to exercise those rights. It is not what they want to do. And the exchange allows them to trade these private lands for lands or rights in Anwar which have an economic benefit to them. In other words, they can take what was supposed to be the economic basis of their corporation, turn it into something that they can use economically, while at the same time preserving their rights to enter upon those lands and also convey to the public the right to enter upon those lands, which right now the public does not have. And the public's right to enter upon those lands has ramifications upon tourism, ramifications upon sport hunting, sport fishing, all those things that all of us as Alaskans, quite frankly, take for granted. So I think that those are considerations that the state has failed to take into account when they withdrew from the exchanges. And though by withdrawing from the exchanges, or when they withdrew, the state did not come out in opposition of the exchanges, I think that their withdrawal from the exchanges was certainly perceived as disapproval of the exchanges, if not opposition. If the state participates in the trades, the state is at the table. They will have access to all information that any of the other participants have. They would be able to take part in the formation of the contract. If they have any particular concerns, they can then...